What's in store for your business this week at Staples?
Doing business like a CEO while saving like a CFO.
Staples has all the supplies you need to run your business like a boss at prices that'll make your bookkeeper smile.
Now that is an achievement.
Everything from markers and pens to 2019 desk calendars.
And right now, a 12-pack of Sharpie markers and an 8-pack of Expo dry erase markers are only $4.99 each.
At Staples, where there's a whole lot in store. Ends 1/19/19 in store only.
The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Bill.
Hi, Gene. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Terrific. Terrific.
How's the weather down there in Florida?
Well, it's probably in the 70s right now, and there's been about a week of sunshine, so that's always nice compared to, you know, what you guys have gone through up in New York,
exactly,
and Jersey, yeah, and so forth. You know, heck, I'm a Floridian, and I ought to be the one getting the hurricanes. That's you guys, you know.
Exactly. We got reversed here. All right, so if you're ready, we can just get started.
Yeah, okay, great.
In the Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, Florida exploitation pioneer Bill Griffey on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Focuses on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Breaking into the film industry at the very dawn of the Florida right-to-work boom, which gave us numerous drive-in independent gems from the likes of Doris Wishman, Herschel Gordon Lewis, Barry Mahon, Harry Kerwin, and Sandy Johnson, Bill learned his craft and honed his skills on the job, producing such well-remembered grindhouse favorites as Sting of Death, Death Curse of Tartu, Stanley, Mako of Jaws of Death, and The Unforgettable Impulse with William Shatner and Harold Oddjob Cicada, before moving on from indie film into the lucrative world of advertising. Winner of a number of Florida-based film awards in the favor of the likes of Quentin Tarantino, Bill comes to us with a host of entertaining stories from the ground level of independent filmmaking throughout his glory days in the 60s and 70s. Join us for an entertaining interview with the one and only Wild Bill Griffey, only here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we talk about his journey from fireman to film director, the Florida film community and the likes of Herschel Gordon Lewis, Barry Mahon, and Doris Wishman, and how actors are like children, only here on Third Eye Cinema. We have with us today a man who's been a bulwark of the Florida film industry from his first feature in 1963 through the heyday of the independent, drive-in, and exploitation film in the 70s. Since 1977, he's been involved in a number of projects in the role of producer, writer, and second unit direction, and has recently begun to give seminars in independent filmmaking. Winner of a number of Florida-based cinema awards, please join me in welcoming Bill Griffey. Bill, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Well, thank you, Gene. Great to be aboard.
I understand that you actually started your career as a fireman. So how did you get involved in the world of first television and then film?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I thought I wanted to be an actor. And in the Korean War, I guess I'd seen too many John Wayne movies, so I joined the military. And when I got out, I got married, and I ended up with three little kids, and I figured, well, boy, acting is not too secure, you know. So anyway, I ended up, I was on the fire department, and when I was there, you know, we were 24 hours on, 48 off, so we had a lot of time during that 24 hours, and I would write screenplays. And I wrote about 10 screenplays, and I have the rejection slips to prove I wrote them. So anyway, finally, I sold one called The Checkered Flag, which we did up in Sebring, and it was about automobile racing and all. And the first day, the director collapsed of a nervous breakdown. And back then, there was nobody in Florida that ever directed a movie before. So the cameraman was an old pro, and so at 1 o'clock in the morning in Sebring, the investors panicked, and they had this big, you know, meeting in the motel room, and what are we gonna do? We gotta get a director from New York or from California. What are we gonna do? And the cameraman said, look, you know, first you got to find a director, and he can't fly in and just start directing a movie without even reading a script or knowing who you cast and all. So he said, what the heck, writer, he knows all about it, make him the director. So they drafted me in a motel room at 1 in the morning, and the next day I started directing the movie, you know.
Wow.
And see, from writing, visually, I visualized scenes, but I knew nothing about lenses or the technical end. So that cameraman sort of carried me through, and I saw that directing a movie is half handling the script and the actors. The other half is the technical end of the camera movements and all. So anyway, I ended up going to the School of Hard Knocks and picking everybody's brains and figuring out. And fortunately, the movie made money, which is the key to make it a second movie. So that's how I got my career and have lasted for 25 feature films.
You were right there at the dawn of the Florida indie film boom alongside the likes of Herschel Gordon Lewis, Doris Wishman, Barry Mann, and Sandy Johnson. How tightly knit was this group of filmmakers? Did you have any real contact with each other?
Well, Herschel and Dave Friedman. See, Dave Friedman produced and Herschel directed. They came down from Chicago, and they called me up and introduced themselves. And, Bill, can you help us with some equipment? And where are all the bodies buried, more or less, you know? Because when you're in a strange city, you know. So anyway, I helped them get crews and equipment. And Herschel and I just had lunch about 2-3 months ago. So, you know, we've remained friends. But I always believed in helping people because, you know, the more people came to Florida, the more I knew that equipment and crews were going to remain here and not disappear. But Doris, funny thing, Doris, I knew Doris. I never, she's sort of, you know, I never got involved in pornos or any of nudies, you know. I strictly was a grindhouse guy and did action and horror movies and so forth. But I was on a panel one time with Herschel and Doris, and I ended up like the referee. Both of them were fighting like cats and dogs. They hated each other, you know. So anyway, Dave Friedman, you know, recently died, and Dave was a great, you know, I got to tell you, can I tell you a funny story about Dave Friedman? I was out in Los Angeles in my hotel and going through the lobby, and here comes Dave Friedman with a big buxom blonde, you know, and I said, hey, how you doing, Dave? And he said, fine. He said, I want you to meet Sally, whatever her name was. I just flew her in from Alabama to star in my new movie. And I said, you know, when I got him aside for a drink later, I said, look, there's 10,000 buxom blondes in L.A. looking for a job. Why are you going to fly this gal in from Alabama, you know? But that was the kind of guy Dave was, you know. You know, once you get the film business in your blood, it's hard to get rid of it.
How about some of the others? Did you have any dealings with, I mean, you said you didn't deal with the nudies and things like that, but do you have any dealings with Barry Mann or Sandy Johnson? Because I know they were active down there as well.
Yeah, Barry, I knew Barry. I never worked with Barry. You know, I knew him. But, you know, there was like William Kerwin. He was we call him the Rooney. He worked with Herschel a lot. He worked with Barry. He worked with me. And he was one of the greatest all-around film guys I've ever met. I mean, he knew camera, he knew sound, he knew lighting, he knew acting. You know, I used him when I did Impulse with William Shatner. I used him as an actor at the beginning of that film. And my one daughter, Melanie, you know, she's a first AD, and she just finished like 4 years on TV series Burn Notice as the first, and she's done about 20 big features with Harrison Ford and, you know, stuff like Waterworld and all that. And so I taught her to have a Rooney kit. And she said, what the heck's a Rooney kit? Well, Rooney had this big bag, and we'd be in the middle of Everglades, and some girl would have a purple button the Rooney kit, and sure enough, he'd have a purple button in the kit, you know. So he had everything in that kit. He was a great guy.
You know, so. Yeah, actually, with you mentioning Bill, he often worked with his brother Harry as well. Did you deal with Harry?
Yeah, I knew Harry, and Harry's wife Betty was a script supervisor, and Betty worked with me on 5 or 6 of my films. Yeah, I knew all the Kerwins, and I just talked to Betty fairly recently. Harry died, you know.
Right. So you guys were all pretty much working together, or at least friendly with each other. You weren't working your own unique silos as much.
Oh, yeah, yeah. See, I mean, I have always been a champion of Florida film. And, I mean, right recently I just did a 5.5-hour seminar, which we just put on DVD. And that seminar, I had like 100 young people there. And I try and tell them the facts of life, you know, because, you know, they go to film school and they get out. And then all of a sudden they say, oh, my goodness, I got to raise money. How do you raise money, you know?
Right.
And they finally raise the money and they finally shoot the movie, and then, oh, I got to distribute it, you know, and a lot of distributors are like sharks circling, ready to gobble them up, you know. So anyway, you know, I got the scars on my back to prove I've made 25 films and survived, you know. So anyway, no, I've always been a champion. I always help any filmmaker, you know, and because I figure if I help them, you know, some of them I might need. Like, we just did a shoot. I've got a new project that I'm interested in doing called Marooned, and we used this new red camera, which is the Red Epic, which is a digital camera, you know. I'm used to shooting with these 35mm cameras. That first film I directed, the camera weighed 200 pounds, you know. And it was a nightmare, you know, with all the editing and the mix and so forth. But right. Now, I tell the kids it's a no-brainer from a technical standpoint to make a movie today.
True.
With all the editing on computers and digital cameras and fast
lenses. It's a lot easier and a lot cheaper.
Yeah, right, cheaper. I said, I tell them the only thing hasn't changed is you got to deal with actors and crews and raising money and distribution, you know. That has not changed that much, you know. But I just love this whole new process because it was a nightmare in the old days when you had to do with heavy cameras and the editing and all, you know.
What do you think brought so many folks to Florida to produce films in the early 60s?
Well, you know, several things. Naturally, you know, the atmosphere and the climate and the scenery was different. But it also, at that time, being a right-to-work state, we had non-union crews and all.
Right.
So you could do a movie a lot cheaper. You know, we're in Hollywood and New York. You had to use so many people. So the independents that were on limited budgets, they came to areas. And Florida was one of the major ones. But then, you know, as we got going, then what was great is we got like 3 different equipment houses and we got a lot of crews, you know. So if you went to just say Alabama or someplace, there was no crews. You had to bring everybody, which was expensive for the per diem and the hotel and transportation and so forth here. So that's what's really helped. And the only thing Florida has always lacked, and that's finance.
Right.
You know, without finance, you're spinning your wheels as far as trying to get a film off the ground.
Your first feature, we already kind of tapped into this one, but it was also your first film script was for The Checkered Flag, and you wound up directing it. Tell us a little bit about that after you finally got in the director's range. How did that work? I mean, did you really just totally rely on your cinematographer?
Well, on The Checkered Flag, I did. But where I saw I had to get a technical background is that I would visualize a scene a certain way. And when I'd look at it, say that a scene called for a 35mm lens, he put on a 50mm, and I'd look at the scene and I'd say, you know, that's not what I visualized, you know. Then sound people, I mean, there's so many tricks. Sound people, they give you, you know, if you don't know the technical end, they got excuses, you know, why the sound was bad, et cetera, you know. And then the assistant cameraman, one of their favorite things was assistant cameraman is a very important job because he's got to follow focus and he's got to load the magazines and everything. Let's say I set up a long dolly shot that had four or five moves in it. Well, if he missed the focus and he wasn't quite sure he got the focus, say, well, let me check the gate. And he'd say, there's a hair in the gate. We got to shoot it again. You know, he'd never say, I missed the mark, you know. I missed the focus. So anyway, over the years, you know, I could do everybody's job. And I, in fact, you know, the way I really learned, see, the second movie I did was Racing Fever, which was the first movie ever made in Florida. It got a major release, which was Allied Artists released it. So what I did there is I shot only on Saturday and Sunday, and Monday I would start pre-production, and I'd go get the locations and the costumes and the props and everything needed. Then Friday I would go rent the truck, because I'd rent it for Saturday, but I knew I could get Sunday free. That's called guerrilla filmmaking, you know. So anyway, I tell the kids I'm the original guerrilla, you know. I mean, on the stuff we used to do, you know. And so then we'd shoot Saturday and Sunday, and then Monday I'd drive the truck back to the equipment house, and then I'd end up starting all over. So anyway, I learned everything on that film just by doing it myself, you know. So
from what you're saying, it sounds to me like when you're dealing with a mechanic in a garage, you know, if you didn't know everything about your car before you went in, you make sure you know it the next time so that he can't bamboozle you. And it sounds like it's the same process here.
It's identical, you know. And, you know, what I try to preach is making a movie is just like building a house. The first thing you got to do is you got to get the blueprints, which is a script. And then you got to get the money. What are you going to do? Get a mortgage? At FHA or what have you, then so you just follow that whole procedure and plan it out, and then the architect draws the house up and the contractor bids it out and et cetera, you know. I've got 10 million C stories with for this interview. You'd be on 24 hours a day, you know. But you know, dealing with actors and crew is you've got to be an amateur psychiatrist, you know. Because everyone is different, and I'll give you a quick example. Do you remember Ruth Roman?
Yes, I do.
Well, Ruth Roman, you know, in her day was a big star. You know,
right.
Alfred Hitchcock, Strangers on a Train, and
right.
Champion with Kurt Douglas, so forth, so on. Well, she was in Impulse, the film I did with Shatner.
Right.
And so the very first scene was by a fish tank. And Shatner said to me, Bill, he said, this guy is like a psycho. He said, well, what happens if in the scene I reached in and I grabbed one of the goldfish, you know? And I said, yeah, that's terrific. That's part of his character. Yeah, do that. Well, Ruth Roman, you knew that was going to steal the scene right out from under her.
Right.
So she said, I'm not doing that. That's not in the script. And she stormed off the set, you know? So fortunately, I'd made five or six movies by then, so I let her stew for a minute. And I was directing, I was not producing, so
right.
I let her stew for about 5 minutes, and then I went outside her door with the first AD, and I said to the assistant director, Gail, I'm sick and tired of these damn temperamental actresses. Get the producer out here right away, you know. And so she could hear me, and, you know, so she stayed in there about another 3 or 4 minutes, and I knew what she was thinking. And she said, this crazy SOB is going to fire me, you know, get me fired, you know. So she came out onto the set, and she said, I thought about it. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to do it. I said, well, Miss Roman, you might be ready, but I'm not ready. She said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you're acting in this film, and you have a character that you're portraying, and if you come up with a great suggestion for that character, we'll use it. But if Mr. Shatner comes up with a suggestion that I don't like, we won't use it. Understand? She says, yes, sir. And we were buddies from then on, see. But if I had given in to her, you know, there's a lot of these old pros, they always test the director.
Right.
You know? And if you haven't got the experience and know how to handle them, you're in deep doo-doo.
It's like dealing with kids.
Right, right.
Yeah. Third Eye Cinema with our guest tonight, Bill Griffey. In our next segment, we talk to recently rediscovered Devil's Sisters, Sting of Death, and Neil Sedaka, only here on Third Eye Cinema. Racing of various sorts, because you had followed the checkered flag with Racing Fever, which was about speedboat racing, and the film had this great ballyhoo come on, you know, the aqua devils who tame their speedboats by day and their racy women at night, and in the grand tradition of such promotion, that promised a lot more than what we were delivered.
Well, you know, the whole thing, as the old distributors like Sam Markoff used to say, you got to have the handle, you know, so... Racing Fever had the handle, but what was interesting, the way that movie came about. Fortunately, the checkered flag was success. So I was at these big hydroplane races, which they had, and there was an Italian driver named Enzio Selva, and he was wiping out every American hydroplane because he had a special supercharged Alfa Romeo engine that was just superior to the American engines. So he was 57 years old, and he said, big announcement, he said, this is going to be my last race, and turning the boat over to my son, who will race it from here on. So he goes out and pours the coal to it, and in the actual movie, you'll see the boat just starts vibrating and takes off and went, and he fell out, and the boat fell on him and killed him instantly.
Yeah. So
and his son jumped off and tried to swim out to him, and there was blood in the water and everything. So being the mercenary I was, I looked around, and I saw some guy up on a truck with a 16-millimeter camera, and I went and ran up to him, and I said, did you get that? And he said, I got it perfect. So I bought that footage from the guy, and I wrote a whole script about it, you know, because, you know, when I tell the kids, you know, I've only made really one movie that was a labor of love. The rest I was just a mercenary SOB and for the money.
Well, that's why they call them exploitation films.
That's right.
So you then moved on to a film which I thought was lost, but which is now getting an upcoming DVD release, which is The Devil's Sisters. So tell us a bit about this one.
Well, The Devil's Sisters, really, I believe it was the best thing I ever did, because it's a true story about these two girls, two sisters in Mexico, and they'd bring these young peasant girls in to Mexico City and Tijuana and all, and they'd tell them they were going to be maids or you know, servants or whatever, and force them into prostitution. And they ended up killing over 100 girls and burying them on a ranch.
Wow.
So they prosecuted these two sisters, and it ended up that we got the court records. We wrote a screenplay on the court records, and we shot that whole thing right in Florida and faked Florida for Mexico. I was blessed with having some really good Cuban actors that had fled to Castro, and so like Velia Martinez was well known in Cuba, and I used her, and then Fred Panero was another Cuban actor. Where I used them, and Bill Marcus, I used him as the Indian in Death Curse of Tartu, and then he played the villain and The Devil's Sisters, and Bill went to Hollywood and done a lot of stuff. What was the movie a couple of years ago that Bridges won the Academy Award about, that a Western singer? Anyway, he won the Academy Award for it. Well, anyway, this Bill Marcus, he played the doctor in that, so...
Next, you did the film that I'll always remember you for, which was the amazing and quite entertaining drive-in picture Sting of Death. When I had Mike Vraney from Something Weird on the show, he made a comment to the effect that nobody films girls shaking their ass like Bill Griffey. It was quite memorable in that respect. You put all those beach party movies and Elvis films to shame with those pool party sequences.
Well, that's my trademark, a low camera angle shooting some gal in a bikini's butt wiggling, you know. So don't tell my wife. Don't let my wife listen.
So how did you land Neil Sedaka, of all people, for the amusing Do the Jellyfish? It was obviously written for the film.
Well, he was doing a thing at the Foundler, you know, just singing and all. Actually, the associate producer of that, I don't know what they paid him. I was directing. I wasn't producing it.
Right.
And so they got him to write the song and do the whole bit, which he probably regrets to this day.
Neil had appeared on screen, albeit fairly briefly, in a Bill Kerwin vehicle around this time, which I think was directed by Harry, Playgirl Killer. So I gather he was either living in Florida or hovering around those circles of Florida indie filmmaking at the time.
I really can't recall.
What was your inspiration for such an original monster in this movie? Because, I mean, the 50s were chock full of mad scientists and atomic radiation, experiments gone wrong, people mutating and all that. But a man who turns into a jellyfish, I mean, to this day, it's one of the more bizarre and memorable screen monsters ever invented.
Well, you know, we had to figure out something for Florida. Well, Florida's got a lot of water, you know, so the fellow Dempsey did the screenplay, and we just came up with this jellyfish monster, which Doug Hobart played, and Doug was also my monster in Death Curse of Tartu. So,
right.
So anyway, for walking around in the flip-flops, and then in the last part of that movie where he had the big jellyfish thing,
right.
You know, we the thing started breathing all the air out of the thing because it was sealed, and we were in a studio shooting that last where they come up through the underwater cave and all of that, and
right.
and Doug is like dying, and you know, I guess we got to cut the thing off and save him, even though it's going to cost us money to get a new jelly head, you know. So anyway, we almost killed Doug on that one by suffocating him to death. But
that actually leads into my next question, because I was going to say, how did you go about creating the look of the monster? Was it really just a bunch of plastic bags and bubble wrap? And did the actor have any issues breathing and all that?
Yeah, well, you know, we I don't know. I can't remember how we blew this big head up, but there was no oxygen or being shot in. We had to shoot it fairly quick because he was breathing and, you know, the air would go out and start collapsing, and then he'd be a jellyfish guy that was swallowed in his own jelly. What was wild is the distributor, Thunderbird, they, in those days, all horror movies were double bill.
Right.
And so he picked up the Sting of Death, and so he's sitting there and he's looking and can't find another horror movie. So he said the magic word, well, if I could get another horror movie as a double bill, I'd finance it. Well, that was the magic word, you know. I said, oh, no problem, you know. And he said, but I got to have it right away. And this was like in December, which April 15th was a magic number because all the drive-ins up north opened
right.
April 15th. Well, back then, as I told you, it was so slow to shoot a film with the heavy cameras and the editing. And, I mean, it took you forever, you know. I had to start shooting immediately, so I said, what the heck can I write, you know? So I just took the age-old story where in Egypt, Pharaoh says anybody disturbs his burial ground, he will come back to haunt him, you know? So I just moved the Egypt to the Everglades and made it an ancient Indian witch doctor that would come back as a wild animal and destroy him, you know?
Right.
So I literally wrote that script in 24 hours. I stayed up all night, wrote the thing. I shot it in 7 days, And the thing is still, like on Netflix, it's still playing.
Okay, jumping back to this thing of death, what really seemed odd is that here's these folks with a nice spread. You know, they got their sort of cabana layout with a pool, and yet they're right there off the swamp, and people travel to their place in one of those Everglades skiffs with a giant fan for a motor. So it was really bizarre in that respect.
Well, that was mainly because the producer had never produced a movie before, and he owned that house. We're going to shoot my house and save money, you know. So he had a beautiful house, you know. So anyway, we had to develop the script of this house, and then they get in a boat, and, you know, they go out into the Everglades and all, which I figured the average guy sitting in Butte, Montana wouldn't know if there's a house next to the Everglades.
I was going to say, you know, you got the pool there, everybody's there in their bikinis, you figure all these gnats and crocodiles will be coming out of the swamp.
Right, right. But, you know, another thing that I learned on that movie, he had a friend that owned a hunting camp in the Everglades. He says, we are going to use, we can get this hunting camp. Well, this shoot in the middle of the Everglades is a nightmare because you've got to take airboats out, you know, the logistics, you waste all the time, and you've got to take a generator, and I mean, it's a nightmare. But no, I'm getting this free, you know. Well, free sometimes. Cost you $10,000, you know. So anyway, he insisted, so we went out there. We get out there, and on the way out, the cameraman had dropped the cord from the battery to the camera overboard. And so now we had to go all the way back into Miami to get a new cord and back out. So anyway, I learned right there that I got a lot of different locations that I can drive a truck to that are the Everglades or they look like the Everglades.
Right.
So from that day on, all my Everglades, I preferred to shoot in a, you know, some place I could drive a truck to, you know.
And I think that the only film that quite captures the particular atmosphere that you have in this movie was Don Borton's Zat 5 or 6 years later. You know, like I said earlier, it's quite a memorable film, and it's definitely one of my favorites, not only of yours, but of this sort of drive-in monster film per se.
Yeah, well, you know, he's a friend of mine, lives in Jacksonville, and he's been trying to get number two out, you know, of that film. But, you know, I don't know if, you know, now if I made Sting of Death 2, they'd probably stone me to death, you know, in the theater.
You know, I'm sure there's a group of people like myself that would love it.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, the love of it is like, as you know, Quentin Tarantino owns the New Beverly Theater
right.
in L.A., and they're grindhouse fanatics out there, and they've had me out twice. You know, I showed Stanley and Impulse, and the second time they wanted to see Impulse again because everybody was hoping Shatner would show up in the theater, you know. I think
right.
that's why they wanted to show it again, you know. But, and then I showed Hook Generation there. There is a lot of grindhouse people still around.
I think more nowadays than ever with the DVD explosion, because people that never, you know, they weren't around for any of this stuff and maybe didn't see it on late night TV or the old horror shows will now see it on DVD or Netflix or streaming.
Right, right. And a lot of it, you know, you mentioned Mike Verrini. Well, Mike really helped get it on to.
Very much so.
In fact, 2 months ago, I was out in Washington State and Mike and I had dinner together. He's a great guy.
You've had a few regulars that you kept bring him back again and again for your pictures. So this might be a good point to talk a little about the first of them. Jill Morrison, who went on to play Captain Harvey and Flipper, was in all three of the aforementioned films, Checkered Flag, Racing Fever, and Sting of Death. So did he drop out of the film circuit when he landed that role?
No, well, he was from Florida. I used him because, you know, he was a good-looking, handsome guy. He's a good actor. But then he, you know, after he got those three films under his belt, then he moved to California, L.A., and he, you know, when you move to L.A., I have a saying, and I tell all the actors and crew members, go to Los Angeles, you go to Hollywood. When Hollywood calls you, you don't go out there looking for a job, you know.
Sure.
Because there's 10 million actors and 10 million crew members. And the perfect example is, you know, my daughter Melanie fortunately took my advice, and she started in Florida, you know, as an assistant, and then she did a film called Funhouse, which you're probably familiar with.
From 1981, the Tobe Hooper one?
Yeah. She was like a PA or, you know, a third assistant or whatever on that. And the people working on that liked her work, and then when they did another film out in California, they called her up and she went out and she's done all the biggies. So if she had to go out and say, "Hi, I'm an assistant director," she'd probably still be waiting tables or something.
You know? True. Like,
California is brutal.
Yeah.
Hollywood is brutal. You know?
Speaking of television fame, Sting of Death also featured Deanna Lund as Jessica, and she would go on to become one of the leads in Land of the Giants. So do you have any memories of her?
Oh, yeah, yeah. She was one of the gals in Sting of Death, and she was engaged to Larry King.
One of the many.
Right, and, you know, Larry King is from Florida. He had a radio show down here, so I was on his radio show a couple of times. Willie Pastrano, do you remember Willie? He was
playing
heavy in Hook Generation. And I used Willie a lot. He was a former light heavyweight champion. I got some really wild stories to tell about Willie. I can't tell them all because you're being censored, I'm sure.
Not really. Actually, we do have a mature rating, so it's safe.
Okay. You want to hear one crazy story about Willie?
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Well, when we did the Hook Generation, you know, at the end, he gets shot by the FBI.
Right.
We're in this swamp. Well, he lived right. I was shooting in a county park, which looked like the Everglades, as I told you, I want to drive a truck in. So Willie, his real character was Rocky. He talked just like Stallone, and in fact, I can't guarantee it, but I think Stallone knew Willie, and he rode Rocky around Willie. Anyway, after the death scene, you know, we used squibs and bullets flying, so he had a .45 revolver, not an automatic, but a revolver.
Right.
So he came up, he said, "Hey, babe," he said, I finished shooting, can I go home?" And because he lived about a half a mile away, and I said, "Yeah, go ahead, Willie." So here he's covered in mud, stage blood, and he doesn't turn in this .45 revolver with six blanks, you know.
Right.
So he staggers out, and there was a little lake there, and there's this man, his wife, and two kids, and they're across the lake, and he staggers out of the woods. He says, "Hey, mother, stop where you are, I'll kill you." Boom, boom, and he starts shooting these blanks, you know. Well, the guy hustles his family into this boathouse, and then he makes a run for it. Willie shot all six shots out of the revolver with blanks, and the guy gets to a payphone. Well, here I'm deep in the swamp shooting, and we hear sirens, and you know, there's about 50 police around. There's a madman loose in the park, you know, shooting at people, you know. And by then, Willie had staggered home, you know. So anyway, that's just one of the, I call them sea stories, you know.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our guest, Wild Bill Griffey. Coming up, we talk Death Curse of Tartu, The Hook Generation, and working with Rita Hayworth. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema.
My name is Y.K. Kim, person who loves martial arts, live with martial arts, and breathe with martial arts. That is Y.K. Kim. I am a grandmaster of martial arts, and at the same time, I'm a producer and director, writer, and actor in the Miami Connection. And I truly enjoyed talking with Gene, Third Eye Cinema. Thank you.
Next, we move on to the film's companion piece on DVD, which, as you mentioned, was Death Curse of Tartu. I remember this being a staple on Saturday afternoon television when I was a kid. The plot is kind of funny, and it's almost arbitrary, because who would want to hold a dance party on an Indian burial ground or be moved to do it during an archaeological dig, for that matter? But it gives us one of those famous Bill Griffey dance party sequences, so I'm glad they did.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You asked who would, and Bill Griffey ought to get a ass shot, right? How do you get a, you're going to do an ass shot of some ancient Indian witch doctor? No, you use a beautiful little gal, you know.
So that's it, they're out there. Help Indian burial ground finalists, let's have a dance party. Woo-hoo!
No, I said it. Also, how do you get a shark in the fresh water in the Everglades? You know?
So after this, you went back into the world of racing with Wild Rebels. There's a bit of a twist, though, in the whole heist caper film angle.
Oh, yeah. What was interesting, you know, since Checkered Flag and Racing Fever had made money, I wrote a script called Pit Stop, and I got the investors, and we were pre-production. And Corman had just done The Wild Angels,
right,
and Variety came out, you know, biggest grossing independent film. And I said, well, that's the next trend, is motorcycle. And I went to my investors and I said, you're going to think I'm nuts, but I don't want to do Pit Stop anymore. I said, I want to write another script. And so I talked him into it, and I'd already, you know, Steve Alamo at the time was a pretty well-known guy. You know, he had his own show on either CBS or NBC called Where the Action Was, you know, that
right.
Dick Clark. So I had him. So anyway, I wrote The Wild Rebels, and with the second motorcycle film out, because I knew that if you start, when a trend starts, if you're the second or third guy out, you normally make money. If you're the sixth or seventh guy out, forget about it, you know. I mean, the trend is over with, you know. And so I've pulled that one off a couple times, you know, doing a trend, jumping on trends, you know.
But where did this whole thing about the heist film, that would seem like a strange angle to throw into this.
Well, I needed some action. I needed a race car driver, you know, and so anyway, and I needed a motorcycle gang. So, you know, I don't know. What do you think? I was smoking something? Or is that what you... I mean, how the hell do I know how I dream this stuff up? I dreamt it up. You know? So anyway...
Speaking of smoking something, in 1968, The Haiti of the Hippie, you gave us The Hook Generation and The Psychedelic Priest. And Bill Kerwin himself makes an appearance in the former as an FBI man. And then we start coming to two more of your regulars, Socrates Ballas, who was also in The Godmothers and who actually produced Impulse. And as you mentioned, Steve Alamo, who was also in The Wild Rebels and your next few pictures in Naked Zoo and Stanley, as well as doing the music for Stanley. And I understand he was a pop singer of some sort. Tell us a little about Socrates and Steve.
Yeah, Steve Alamo was a big bubblegum idol at the time. And as I said, he had his own show on the network, a network show that Dick Clark produced. It was called Where the Action Is. But then Steve, at the height of his career, he just dropped out and started producing records. And he owns his own music studio now, and he's a music producer. He did stuff like Casey and the Sunshine Band and so forth. So he was smart, you know, because he knew as a performer, a lot of them are limited. And so he got into producing records and been very successful. But since he had a following on that network show, you know, so I started him in the film business. And in this documentary I'm doing, they interviewed him, and he sort of thanked me for getting him in the feature film business, I guess. I don't know.
And what about Socrates?
Well, Socrates had been my assistant in a couple of my films. And when Socrates, he wanted to produce, you know, and so he moved to Tampa, and when he got the money to do Impulse, he called me up and asked me if I would direct it. So Socrates, that was the first movie he produced, and which I directed for him. But I used, you know, I always, if I get along good with somebody and they're not prima donnas, if they're regular people, well, then I use them over again. If they're prima donnas, they never see me again.
That's a good philosophy.
Right.
So Hook Generation had more of what was to become a typical drive-in staple plot with the low-rent drug deal ripoff and double cross that goes horribly wrong. But Psychedelic Priest, which is originally titled Electric Shades of Grey, I understand, which makes it suddenly timely with this whole Shades of Grey thing. The film was interesting in a few ways. First of all, I understand it was never released at the time, but you gave Mike Vraney at Something Weird what may be the only existing print from your personal collection for that DVD.
No, I didn't give it to him. Some other guy got, I didn't have a print of it, and some other guy got it to him. See, this is a wild story. You know, this was at the time of the hippies. I mean,
right.
And Sunset Boulevard was solid hippies. I mean, it was just, they were sleeping in doorways and so forth. So I got a call from the crazy producer I knew. He calls me, Bill, I got a great idea for, get on a plane, fly out here, direct this movie, you know. And I said, well, send me a script. And he says, well, and he told me the story. And it was a story, a young priest leaves the church and travels with all the long hairs, you know. So I'd been around the block, you know. And I said, well, no, I need X number of dollars and send me a round trip air ticket, you know. So about a week later, the round trip ticket comes, and I flew out, and I never read the script. You know, just went, I liked the concept because that's what was happening. I get out there, and he says to me, I don't have a script. I'm in serious trouble. And I said, well, you don't have a script. What are you talking about? And he said, well, you know, what I did is they had what they call trading stamps, which was a way to try and beat the IRS. And what it was a trading stamp deal that if you, let's say you had a TV shop and I had an auto garage, you needed your transmission fixed. Well, you'd give me trading stamps, and if I wanted a new television, I'd give you the So he'd raise these trading stamps, and he discounted them 50 cents on the dollar to get me out to California. So I had to stay at the Ramada Inn because that was a trading stamp deal. And I ate every meal in the Ramada Inn. And finally, after 3 days of that, I said, Terry, I'll buy. Let's go across to the New World and have dinner. So we go to the New World, and there was some hippies in there. And there was this one girl with the long dress and the long hair. I said, nah, she looks like a typical hippie, you know, for the movie. This Griffey, you're brilliant. I knew why I hired you. And he rushes over and he says, well, this gal had never acted in her life before, so now we got our female lead. So the next morning we're having breakfast in the Ramada Inn, naturally. In walks this actor that he's got they have like a portfolio that they carry or whatever of their pictures. And I said, now that guy looks like a young priest. Oh, man, you're right. And he goes over, now we got our priest, but we got no script, you know. So we winged that whole movie. I shot the whole movie with no, you know, absolutely no script. We just winged the whole thing. And afterward, I became president of Ivantor Studio, you know, which we did Flipper and Gentle Ben. So I didn't want my name associated with a drug-related hippie film, you know, because, I mean, you know, it was Ivan was strictly a family-type thing, you know. So I just took credit, you know, as the cameraman on the thing, but it was a wild experience, and I could bore you with a lot of crazy, crazy things happened on that film in the hippie days. But
so it was all improvised on the fly, and you got mainly non-actors that you just pulled in off the street. Also, it was never released, as I understand, until it hit DVD 5 or 10 years ago. But on top of all that, you're telling me that you actually got involved with the company that produced Flipper, so you've got the Joe Morrison connection again. How did all this happen?
Well, Ivan knew my film work. They were going to make a change to the studio, so they approached me when I wanted to head the studio. So I told them, I said, well, it's more or less when you head a studio, you're sort of desk-bound. So I made a contract that I could do one independent film a year, but I had to give Ivan the first crack at it. So anyway, I sat behind a desk and ran the studio. But then we'll get into it later, but one picture I did when I was president of Ivantor was Stanley, which Ivan did want to do because it was killing and all that kind of stuff in it.
Is that why the Psychedelic Priest was never released?
No, the guy, I'm trying to remember the distributor's name. Joe Solomon. He was a big producer. producer and distributor at the time. When the film was edited, the producer went in and Joe Solomon liked the film to release, and
right.
they ended up in a fist fight. And so he got sort of blackballed off of that. I never was involved in the distribution or anything because it's amazing when I look at the film, I don't know how the hell I ever did it with no script or anything. We just winged the whole movie, you know.
And, you know, it's funny because you had no script, but the theme was interesting because, you know, the whole concept of a priest dropping out of the church to try to connect with the youth of the day and then finding his way back, that was actually very timely because Vatican II just came out around that time. So the church was actively trying to resonate with the people, and particularly the youth of the time, and not only moved away from things like, you know, the old Latin mass, the priest facing away and all that, but they were pulling in lay people to do the readings and integrating contemporary folk for the music. I remember a lot of stuff from when I was a kid, you know, like hippie types with acoustic guitars, harmonizing religious songs rather than the usual Gregorian chants and carols and such. But it's strange because nowadays they seem to have given up that idea and turned back towards the more traditional archaic forms. And that may actually be part of why they've lost any relevance or footing, because the churches are literally dying along with their aging congregations.
I got to give credit to Terry. He came up with the idea, and then, you know, he gave me the sales pitch over the phone, and I knew it was very timely. But still, even with a, as I say, I get so many calls from people. I got a great idea for a script. Well, you know, that's beautiful. Everybody's got some idea for a script, but you got to get the script to get the financing and all that. Anyway, but you can interview 10 million filmmakers. I'll guarantee you, you've never met a filmmaker on your program that made a movie on trading stamps.
No, that's a first. From here, you change gears again and put out a picture that's a bit of an anomaly in your filmography, which is The Naked Zoo. First of all, it's the first of your films to feature a mainstream film heavyweight, because you've got Hollywood legend Rita Hayworth in her last role. And secondly, it's a more standard melodrama revolving around her having an affair and running into some trouble with her jealous husband. What led you to make a film like this? It's someone outside the usual drive-in fare you were known for.
Well, you know, I really never, I'm most noted with the Grindhouse group for horror movies and, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, when you look at several of my films, I mean, I sort of never fell into a complete genre. So at the time, the whole hippie movement, Coconut Grove at the time, was like Haight-Ashbury out in Frisco. So, you know, I just came up with the idea, older woman, young gigolo type, and so forth. But, you know, I developed the script, and Stephen Oliver, you know, one of the stars of that TV series, Peyton Place, when I was able to sign Rita, which is a whole story in itself, which, do you want to hear the story? How I
sure, go ahead.
I sent the script out, and the agent, my whole budget, which was one of the biggest budgets I ever had, was $250,000. So when I set the script out and they were interested, the agent said, "How much you want?" I said, $250,000 for Rita. And I almost choked to death, you know. And I said, "Well, look, you know, the only thing I can only afford $50,000. There's no way I can go." So anyway, he and I argued for three solid days, and nothing. He wouldn't give. So I call up my investors in Florida, and I said, "Guys, you got to trust me. Wire me $50,000." So they wired me $50,000, and I got a cashier's check, and I walked into that agent. I said, "There's $50,000. I'll put that in escrow in any bank in California for Rita." But end the story. Guy said, "You got a deal." So am I allowed to use any profanity?
Go right ahead.
There's an old saying, money talks and bullshit
walks, right?
So anyway, that's the lesson I learned with Hollywood, Tinseltown, dealing with them. You know, if you got the money, you can make deals. If you don't have the money, forget about it.
Beyond the whole thing of trying to get her, what was it like working with Rita? Did she bring any stories about her marriage to Orson Welles?
Yeah, well, you know, I knew. See, I'm a 1-2, maybe 3-take guy at the most. So I knew if I started out with 1 or 2 takes with Rita, I was dead in the water, because she's from the Hollywood school. You know, they do 10, 12, 15 takes and all that. So anyway, I put in my budget, and I was doing like 10 takes the first day, and then the second day I'd cut it to 8 takes. Until she built confidence in me. And then we got where we were just doing a couple, 2 or 3 takes, you know. And, but there again, get is that psychological thing. You got to figure out people, you know. You know, she was married to the Ali Khan, and she just, of all of her husbands and boyfriends, she loved Orson Welles the most. She said he was the most talented guy, you know. And I was very fortunate that I met Orson Welles, and I said to him, did you ever regret leaving New York and your great stage career and radio career there and coming to Hollywood? And Orson said, the only thing that I regret is I've spent 10% of my time making movies and 90% of my time trying to get money to make movies. So that's what I tell the kids. If Orson Welles had trouble raising money, I mean, what the hell does the average filmmaker go through, you know? So anyway, but she loved Orson Welles with a passion. But what was so crazy about Rita is she was really a very shy person. Screen image was completely different than her personality. And she was scared to death of automobiles because she'd had, I think the Ali Khan was killed in an automobile wreck. And then some other close boyfriend or whatever was killed. So my poor wife one time had a driver and she was like under the dashboard half the time. Scared to death, you know. So anyway, and she was just starting to get Alzheimer's, and we thought, you know, we didn't know anything about Alzheimer's at the time. We just thought she was on a drunk, you know. So she was out for like 3 or 4 days with a spell, and I had to shoot all around her, which was a nightmare to do. But you know, she was a real nice lady. And
one thing I'd only heard mentioned once, so I don't know if it's true or not, but apparently you did some second unit work on Live and Let Die with Roger Moore, Yaphet and Jane Seymour on Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
How'd you get involved in that?
Well, I had met Cubby Broccoli and his associate I met at the Cannes Film Festival. So they knew that I had worked, you know, underwater stuff and knew I was from Florida and all. And so one thing led to the other. And when they were ready to do it, they called me up because they were going to shoot a lot of stuff in Florida and New Orleans, and they knew I knew. So I sort of coordinated all that kind of stuff and then did the underwater shark footage and all for them.
That's what I was going to ask. What sequences were you responsible for, and if you got to work with any of the main actors?
No. Second unit, you never work with the main actors unless it was like, I mean, that's why they call it second unit, because
right. It's all the pickup stuff.
Yeah, they do the pickup stuff, so I never worked with Roger Moore or anybody. You know, I just helped coordinate, you know, all of the action stuff and the stuff over it. You know, when we did the Jamaican stuff with the crocodiles and alligators over there, I remember the scene.
You did another variation on the Hook Generation with Alligator Alley in 1972. I haven't seen this one, but I understand it's another small-time drug deal ripoff gone wrong, this time revolving around heroin.
No, that's a ripoff. That is the Hook Generation, and some pirate put it out as Alligator Alley.
Really?
Yeah. It's the same film.
Wow.
So you think Johnny Depp is a pirate? He ought to meet some of these guys that are releasing DVDs.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest, Wild Bill Griffey. Up next, we talk Stanley and His Faith, The Godmothers, Cafeterias and Digits, and The Amazing Impulse featuring the legendary William Shatner. You're on Third Eye Cinema.
Guys and girls, my name is Nico Mastorakis, and if it's all Greek to you, Google me. I have written, produced, and directed several movies, not all of them good movies, some of them very good movies, but more interesting than the movies themselves is a lengthy interview at Third Eye Cinema. If you miss it, you don't like movies.
Now we get to what you've been waiting for all along. One of your more famous pictures, Stanley. Now, this was quite a grim film. It was very much in the same vein as something like Twisted Brain or Kiss of the Tarantula, with an outsider who finds that the only things he's attached to, if they're viciously attacked, then he has to go after his tormentors with ironic revenge. We've already discussed the star Steve Alamo, but you also brought in Alex Rocco, who was known at the time for similar independent driving films like Detroit 9000, Brute Corps, Bonnie's Kids, and Blood Mania. But he'd also been in big films like The Godfather and had quite an extensive career in television. So how did you land Alex? Was he anywhere near as gruff and explosive as he tends to come off on screen?
Oh, well, as I said, I am the original gorilla. Alex was Paramount promoting The Godfather before it was released in Florida. And the distributor knew Alex, and so I called up the distributor and said, Alex is in town. He'd be great for this part. So I got Alex, and Paramount paid for his hotel bill and his per diem.
Wow.
In fact, 2 weeks ago, I just talked to Alex for the first time in a long time. They're doing a TV series here in town, and Alex playing the part, and my daughter ran into him and said, hi, I'm Melanie Griffey. He says, you're Bill's daughter? I said, well, that son of a bitch threw me to a bunch of rattlesnakes in a pool with water moccasins. You know? So he called me up, you know, and so we had a good talk, you know. But do you want to hear the story?
Go ahead.
Well, you know, in the movie, you know, Alex came up to me and he said, Bill, he said, I'm deathly afraid of snakes, you know. So I can't get in that pool with a bunch of snakes, you know. And I said, Alex, no problem. I got a couple rubber snakes. I'll just do a lot of close-up fast cuts. And so anyway, oh, thanks a lot. You know, so he didn't know it. I had four handlers hiding behind the building. He had two snakes apiece. You know? And Alex comes off the board at the water, and we hit him with about 10 or 12 snakes, you know. It was sudden, you know, he's supposed to be panicked, you know.
Right.
So he was really panicked, you know. When we were doing the editing, you know, we didn't notice, you know. So anyway, in the soundtrack, when we're editing, pops to the surface and sees all these real snakes, and he screamed, Griffey, you son of a bitch! So anyway, but he was on Good Morning America. He won the Emmy for some TV thing he did. I forget what it was. But they said, did you ever make a movie where you had problems? And he says, well, it was this crazy director in Florida that fed me to a bunch of snakes in a swimming pool, you know. So anyway, but, you know, the way Stanley came about is very interesting. As I said before, if you hit a trend, you're on the right track if you're the second guy out, you know. So I was in Bill with Ivan Torres, and I was out in L.A. on business, and here Variety picks up Willard, biggest grossing film, you know. So I thought, wow, animal, that's the next horror trend, animals. So I ended up, I don't know what the hell I ate that night, but I dreamt the whole story of Stanley.
Wow.
I woke up and I said, Mike, that's pretty good. And so I went to see Red Jacobs, who had released Wild Rebels. He was a distributor. So I said, Red, I got a great idea for a movie. And Red said, well, leave me the screenplay. I'll read it over the weekend. And I said, I don't have a screenplay. And he said, well, leave me a synopsis. Let me read some. I said, I don't have a synopsis. And he said, Griffey, get the hell out of my office. Why are you bothering me with this shit? You know. Well, he was one of these guys that he had these damn Cuban cigars that were about a foot long, and he had a whole box of them. And so I said, calm down, Red. Let me tell you a story. I told you, get the hell out of my office. Don't bother me. And I reached in, and I grabbed a handful of those. Put those down, you son of a bitch. You're stealing. They cost $5 a piece, those cigars, you know. So anyway, I finally calmed him down, and I told him the whole story. And when I finished, he said, how much will you make this movie for? And I said, $125,000. And he says, you got a deal. Well, even though he was a rough old buzzard. His handshake was better than any Hollywood contract today, you know.
Right.
So I shook hands, and he said, I'm only going to put one monkey on your back. I got to have it April 15th in the theater. And here it was like November. And so I said, what am I going to do, you know? So I had to take the red eye back to Miami. Well, I knew this crazy writer, Gary Crutcher. Mm-hmm. The first time I met Gary, he came up to my hotel room, and he had this briefcase. And I said, well, can I read some of your screenplays you've written? And he opens it up, and he's got a 45 automatic. He's got a dagger, and he's had his line with pills. And Gary was a pill popper, you know? So I thought, Gary Crutcher, he can write the screenplay for me. So I call up Gary and I said, meet me at the L.A. airport. I got to have a script written right away. So I met him and I sat with a yellow pad and I wrote down these characters. And I wrote down scene one, this happened. And this was a Friday night and I told Gary, I said, Gary, I got to have a screenplay Tuesday in Miami. Well, back then there was no emails or faxes or anything, which meant he had to write the thing, put it on an airline Monday to get it to me Tuesday. So Gary just popped pills for like 3 days, wrote the whole screenplay, you know. And so we ended up shooting immediately, you know, and I had it for Red April 15th. And
wow.
As you know, it's in it when it's like 6th or 7th release VHS and DVD. It's just unbelievable.
I understand that you still own the snakeskin vest that Alex Rocco wore in the picture.
Yes, I do. I'm not going to give it to you either. But I did. Daniel Griffin, who did all of the extras, Stanley, I made into a wallet. And it had the blood stains on it where I'd whacked him with a machete or something. I forget how we killed him. But anyway, I gave the wallet to Dan.
Wow.
So Stanley was, if you believe this or not, you know, was released in L.A. against The Godfather. And The Godfather was the most expensive movie Hollywood made that year. And The Godfather grossed $183,000. Stanley grossed $175,000.
Wow.
So the old saying, you know, best thing I learned from Sam Arkoff, the listeners probably don't know who Sam Arkoff is. Well, anyway, Sam told me, he said, Bill, I have never heard of one person walking up to the box office and before they say to the cashier, oh, what did this movie cost to make? And they get there because of the subject matter, the who's in it, the something gets them there, the title of the movie. And as you know, Sam was and Jimmy Nicholson were famous for doing low-budget stuff.
Yeah, with their pinching pennies.
Right. So that was a good lesson I learned, you know, that it's not, you know, how much you spend on a movie. It's if you make one interesting enough to get them to go to the theater.
Exactly. Now we come to another real joker in the deck, which was The Godmothers with Mickey Rooney, Billy Barty, and Frank Fontaine. Crazy Guggenheim himself. They're singing,
right,
cross-dressing, and a lot of outdated slapstick. How did you get involved in this one?
Well, Mickey was living down here. So there was a guy that wanted to be a film producer. He'd never produced a movie, you know, and he was in awe of, oh, Mickey Rooney, you know. So anyway, a couple people that were involved in that, they hired me to direct the thing, and the biggest problem I had is Mickey was the writer. I don't know if you remember the scene where they were in a Japanese restaurant. Well, Mickey comes to me at 7 in the morning, and we were going to shoot a completely different scene. Mickey says, I stayed up all night. I got a great idea. And he hands me these 8 pages that I'd never seen before, and it's a Japanese restaurant. So anyway, I went to the producer. I said, this is insanity. We don't have any costumes or anything. Oh, but Mickey Rooney wants to do it. Go ahead. So anyway, we didn't start shooting till like 2 in the afternoon. We had to go out and get him and Jerry the costumes. We had to go secure a Japanese restaurant. And so anyway, I mean, on that movie, you know, I had what, 4 or 5, like Joey Ross. I had all these stand-up comedians. And I don't think I directed the movie. I think I was a traffic cop. because I had all of these guys, everybody was coming up with ideas. And a funny story on Billy Barty,
right,
is my Gary Crutcher, who wrote Stanley, was also, he was in the story department at Columbia Pictures, and Billy Barty, I came over and had an idea for the midget detective, his pitch, you know. So Gary took him to the commissary, which was a cafeteria, and Gary said, never bring a dwarf or a midget to a cafeteria, because he couldn't see the food. You know? But Gary said I had to pick him up to for him to see what he wanted to eat. You know?
Wow.
So anyway, yeah, that was a crazy movie with all those Jerry Lester and Mickey and Frank Fontaine and Joey Ross and Billy Barty. I mean, a nightmare, you know.
It just seemed like it's totally out of left field. Where's this coming from?
Right.
Then you did a much beloved film by aficionados of this sort of thing, including myself, Impulse. I mean, this kitsch classic of a serial killer tale features some very over-the-top lead performances by William Shatner and Goldfinger's Harold Sakata, who you actually billed as Harold Oddjob Sakata, and whose character was named Karate Pete. I also love the alternate title, Wanna Ride, Little Girl? So tell us a little bit about this one and working with Shatner and Sakata.
Well, Tony Kruchelis wrote the script, and it was called Wanna Ride, Little Girl. And the way we got Shatner, as we said before, Socrates had worked with me on a lot of my films, and so this was his first producing thing. So we wanted to try and get a name actor, and so we went to the Miami airport, and we were going to L.A. to talk to some casting people and all. And we're walking through the airport, and here comes Shatner. And I said, my God, there's William Shatner. I said, he'd be good for this part. So we grabbed Shatner, and we talked to him, handed him a script, and talked him into doing the movie, which, you know, was completely different for him, because he...
Right.
But then, the way the script was written, I had been around a lot of con men in my life, and so I knew they don't come right out and ask for money. They try and make it that they are doing you a favor. And so, you know, Shatner and I and Tony all said, and we added a lot of stuff to that thing, and then that's what I try to do with Shatner. You know, what gets me is critics, some critics tear Shatner to ribbons on that, but European critics love Impulse. They love it. And I can, if you go on the internet, I can show you some really good stuff they wrote about Shatner in that. But I told them at the New Beverly when I showed it, I said, well, I'll take responsibility for everything but the costumes. Because Socrates had made a deal with some clothing store there, and some of Shatner's wardrobe is pretty...
Oh, it's incredible, yeah.
Well, I'm not responsible for the wardrobe on that film.
This was actually my favorite period in Shatner's career, because he turned up in a number of fun pictures like King of the Spiders, Devil's Reign, Horror at 37,000 Feet, Visiting Hours, and The Killing of the President around this time. He was quite a familiar face in exploitation and always brought some unique presence and his signature intensity in any role he took on. You had some real zingers in this movie. I really got a kick out of Bill Kerwin's cameo in the flashback.
right, at the beginning, yeah.
Right.
It's just black and white, and then we went to color, yeah.
Shatner himself was amazing. I think my favorite part was when Ruth Roman was trying to get into the safe, and he was jumping up and down like a 5-year-old. It's like,
Open the safe.
So you didn't actually write the script, because there's so many drop-dead funny lines in this movie.
Yeah. Well, Tony came up with some good lines, but Shatner's character I changed a lot because of the con man aspect. But anyway, it got Shatner's. I call him the ever-ready bunny. You know, the guy never stops. He just keeps going.
So much energy.
I'll tell you an interesting thing on Impulse. Remember the scene where he is in the car wash and he hangs Sakata? All right, we had the rig on Sakata, and during the filming, the rig actually slipped. Sakata was choking to death. Well, anybody else, it would have broken their neck, you know,
right.
But Sakata's neck made a linebacker for the NFL look like a weakling, you know. His neck was so big. Well, Shatner noticed it, and Shatner starts to pick him up and cut the rope, cut the rope. He's choking to death. I think Bill Kerwin was on the roof. He was working as a grip, and he cut the rope. And,
is that why you had the whole sequence where he actually fell out of the noose?
No, we had to shoot it again because we cut the rope. But anyway, unbeknownst to me, some guy had filmed that with a 16-millimeter behind-the-scenes stuff. And I never knew that till about a year ago. And the guy gives me the DVD, and he has the whole thing where Shatner grabs him and all of this. So when I was out at the New Beverly Theater, I call up Shatner, and I told him. He says, oh, I got to see this. Come by my office. So I went by, and I put the DVD, and we showed it to him. And Shatner said, this is unbelievable. It's great behind the scenes. He said, but there's no sound to it. Why isn't there any sound? And so I said, well, the guy was shooting like a whole movie. He didn't have a sound equipment or anything. He said, oh, man, I'd record that if we had any sound equipment. I said, you would? You know, so Daniel Griffith and Gary Crutcher were having a lunch down at the Jerry's, which is right on Ventura Boulevard there. So I get on the cell phone and I said, get over here. Shatner wants to record this. And so Gary Crutcher, crazy Gary, you know, said, I just ordered a banana split. To hell with Shatner. I'm going to finish it. And I said to Daniel, I said, Daniel, you tell Gary that if you guys aren't over here in 5 minutes, I'm going to take that banana split and shove it up Gary's ass is what I'll do. Now get over here. You know, so anyway, they came over, and Shatner, you know, in person, Shatner's a funny, funny guy, you know. And so he narrated this whole thing, and so this is going to be in the documentary they're doing, They Came from the Swamp. Oh, one other interesting thing for any young filmmakers that I did on Impulse, you know, the scene where he kills the woman and the car goes in the water? Well, the way Hollywood would have done that, you know, it called for a wealthy woman. And the wealthy woman, they would have bought a brand new car, and they would have had a stunt person in the car, and they would have had about 3 or 4 cameras, and they would have set the whole thing up, and the stunt person would have gone into the water, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, I didn't have the money, so in pre-production, I went to Hertz Rent-A-Car, and I told them we were shooting this movie in Tampa. I said, can I rent this brand new car? And I picked the car out, and I said, can you hold it for me? And we're shooting July 15th or whatever it was. They were in awe that we were doing a movie in Tampa.
Right.
So they said, yeah. So anyway, I sent the guys out to a junkyard. I said, find me a junker. Didn't have to have an engine or transmission or anything. Just find me a junker and paint the hood the same color as this car. So they got this old junker. So the way I filmed it is I had the brand new Rent-A-Car, and he kills the woman.
Right.
When he moves the body, he gets out and he hits the gear shift. Then I put an underwater camera in the back of the car, and you see the car going down the hill and crash into the water, and then, you know, all the water comes up over the camera and all. Then I sent a diver down to get the camera and all.
Right.
And so I did that whole shot for $200. for the junker.
Wow.
And then what I did afterward is we got the car out of we got a wrecker, and I sent a diver down, got the car out, and then I dumped the car into the swimming pool of the hotel we were staying at, and that's where I did the underwater shot of the dead woman in the car, you know. So when I tell the kids, you know, Hollywood solves problems with money, and when you're a gorilla, you solve problems with your mind trying
exactly
to figure out how to do this stuff, you know.
That's the difference. Where did you find that child actor? Because even with somebody like Shatner being so over the top and Cicada, this girl really stood out. She may be like the single worst child actor I've ever seen on film. I kept hoping for Shatner to take her out.
She was a local Miami girl, you know. So, you know, you go with what you've got. You know?
Right. Cicada actually had a very odd delivery. I can see why Broccoli and Saltzman kept his part silent in Goldfinger. I love when he karate chopped that big hole in the end table, and then you have that huge motorhome with Karate Pete on this big sheet hanging off the side.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you think we were going to paint a real rent a RV? I mean, that would have cost us money, so we just pasted the sign on the side.
It really works into how the film, you know, the whole film experience. Like, wow, this is incredible. And it's funny, too, considering the story that you told me about the hanging incident, because that whole scene where, you know, Shatner's dancing around and boxing at him while he's hanging from the noose, but that's still not the end, because then he cuts himself free and then you get the car wash scene. I mean, it's not something you would expect. That one and Sting of Death are actually my favorite of all your pictures.
Well, you know, what's interesting, that car wash thing, you know, we shot all night in the car wash, and when he pulled through and he was ready to run over Cicada, the damn sun was just on the horizon, and I knew I couldn't come back to do that another night, and I knew if the sun came up for the next 10-15 minutes, we were out of business. It'd be too light, you know. So I said to the DP, give me that handheld camera, just follow me with a couple lights. And I took Cicada and Shatner, and I shot that whole thing where he runs him over and puts him in the trunk and the girl and the whole thing. I shot all that in about 5 or 6 minutes.
Wow.
So I shot all of that with a handheld Aeroflex.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Wild Bill Ruffet. In the next part, we talk Mako, Joys of Death, and hilarity and hijinks on Whiskey Mountain. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema. You actually kept Cicada for your next picture, which is Mako, the Jaws of Death of Richard Jekyll, who had just come off William Gergely's Grizzly. This one's more or less another Stanley, albeit with some then-trendy ESP, shamanist, and corporate conspiracy elements tacked on. So in other words, it's another very memorable Bill Griffey film. Tell us a little bit about this picture.
Well, Richard Jekyll was really, he was the most cooperative, best actor I ever worked with in my life. The guy in the whole movie, he only blew one line. He was the star of the movie. He was so prepared. This movie was the worst experience I ever had on a film because the investors bounced a $150,000 check on me.
Oof.
And, you know, the crews and everybody, they don't care that some guy in California and Europe bounced a check. All they know is Bill Griffey hired me. And so I had a hell of a decision to make, whether I was going to just wrap the movie or I was going to shoot for a week, because they kept BSing me, oh, yeah, I will wire the money, and blah, 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 blah. So I gambled for a week, and every Friday they'd wire the money, and my poor wife would be waiting at the bank. How I ever, because I was producing and directing, how I ever made that movie, I'd never know. Sweating bullets. But anyway, Richard Jekyll, the very first day, my whole directorial scheme was revolved around the Aeroflex BL, which was the first handheld blimp camera they had.
Right.
And before then, we used these big Mitchells, which were a couple hundred pound cameras, and was a nightmare. But I knew I had a lot of boat shooting, so there was only two of them in the United States. One was in Miami, and one was in L.A. And so the first day, we have the camera, and the assistant had it on the tripod, and he's loading the magazines and all. And the assistant, when they finish, they pick it up and put it on their shoulder. The threads had cross-threaded on the camera. The damn camera goes off and hit it right on the lens and broke the camera. And so I'm in rehearsing the actors, and Richard Jekyll wasn't there. And so first AD comes in and says, Bill, are you sitting down? I said, yeah, what's the matter? He said, we just wiped out the camera. you wiped out the camera. What the hell are you talking about? You know, we haven't even shot anything yet. So anyway, I said, well, go get the Mitchell. I've got to wing this some way.
Right.
So I said, well, look, I got this wild Aerie. I said, bring the boats up, and I'll shoot the boats coming. So he said, fine. So the assistant goes out to get the boats, and I'm in rehearsing the actors. AD comes in and says, Billy is sitting down. I said, what the hell's wrong now? He said, we brought the boats in, but they got stuck on a sandbar. It'll be 5 hours before the tide rises to get them off, you know. So I almost panicked, but I didn't quite panic. And I said, well, look, I got this wild Aerie. I got a scene with Richard Jekyll, who wasn't going to be in the first shot. I said, go get Richard. And I said, I'll do this with a wild Aerie, and we can loop it later. And so Richard said, oh, yeah, no problem, you know. So Richard goes out to get in the wardrobe, and so I'm in rehearsing the other actors. AD comes in. Billy is sitting down. Shit, what the hell's wrong now? He said, we just rushed Richard Jekyll to the hospital.
Oh my goodness.
Jumped on the prop truck, split his head wide open, and he's bleeding like a stuck pig, you know. So now I got no camera, I got no boats, and no lead actor, you know. But to his credit, within 2 hours, Richard came back. He had stitches in the back of his head, insisted on working. And the guy never missed a beat. Where I've worked with so many name actors, they'd be out for a week and all of this, you know. But Richard was a true pro, you know.
You actually brought this one out almost immediately after Jaws came out. And personally, I could tell you which picture I found more entertaining. Sorry, Spielberg. But seriously, this is another of my favorite series after Sting and Death and Impulse. And it doesn't have the same nasty edge that Stanley did, despite having the same dark turn halfway through. I felt more sympathy towards Jekyll and his connection with the sharks than I did with the Lame-O and the snakes. Maybe it was just because we were moving into the latter half in the 70s, but there's like a brighter feel to it. It's not as unrelentingly grim and despairing as Stanley was.
Yeah, well, the way people always say, oh, Griffey, you ripped off Spielberg and Jaws, you know. Well, I developed Mako Jaws of Death way before they did Jaws, and I couldn't get arrested, you know, and nobody would back it. So when Jaws came out, here again, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Jaws, biggest grosser, blah, blah, blah. So all of the people that had read my story on Mako Jaws of Death, they called me up, Bill, old buddy, how the hell are you, you know, and were kissing my ass to, you know, get this thing made, because they knew I could get it out immediately, and they could cash in on the shark frenzy, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I got the money immediately, which the $150,000 check bounced. And anyway, what was interesting about that, anybody that's old enough can remember, it was Life magazine, Time magazine, everything was sharks, you know.
Right.
And so when I finished the film, I didn't even edit the film. I edited a 7-minute promo reel. And we took that 7-minute promo reel to Europe, which Universal had not released Jaws yet. And we beat Universal out in Europe with Mako Jaws of Death. Before Jaws was released, and we had our money back before I'd even edited the movie off of advances we got, you know.
Wow.
So anyway, what I did is I ripped off Universal's publicity department. I didn't rip off the Spielberg script, you know. So there again is the gorilla in me, you know.
And finally, we come to what was effectively your last film as director, 1977's Whiskey Mountain. You even got Charlie Daniels to do the soundtrack, and he was only a year or two away from becoming a major performer artist. The Devil Went Down to Georgia and In America. I've seen the trailer for this one, and it looks great. So why isn't it out on DVD? Are there any plans to get this one out there?
Yeah, there is plans to get it out, and it was just a situation that couldn't get the negative. But we're on the track of a really good print, and if we can get the good print, we'll have it out on DVD. But interesting how I got Charlie. Charlie was a big star in the South. I mean, he wasn't as well-known nationally, but I had this guy that worked with me in the music department, and he was a doper, you know, and he was always stoned out of his mind. And so I'd shot Whiskey Mountain, and we were editing on the movie Ola, and he comes in the editing room. movie for Charlie Daniels to do the music. And I said, yeah, give me a break. I can't afford Charlie Daniels. He said, no, Charlie's a good friend of mine. And I said, oh, he is? Well, got his phone number? He said, yeah. And I said, well, here's a phone. Call him up. And the son of a bitch gets Charlie on the phone, you know. And so Charlie said, gee, it sounds interesting, but he said, I've got these one-nighters, and he said, we're playing three gigs a week, and he said, I can't cancel and do this. So anyway, so I thought that was the end of Charlie Daniels, you know. So anyway, about 2 weeks later, the guy comes in. Charlie just called me, and he was opening a walnut, and a knife went right through his guitar hand.
Ooh.
And so he said, come to Nashville and show him the movie. Well, you know, I had a rough cut. I didn't have any sound effects or music. So I flew up to Nashville with this stoned musician. So we met Charlie in the lobby, you know, and Charlie's chewing tobacco, and he's got a big tin can, and he said, well, you must be Bill Griffey. Boom, and he said, that's tobacco in the can, you know. So anyway, that's how I got Charlie Daniels. And Charlie wrote all the music and the original score and all that. And what was interesting, you know, Charlie plays 7 instruments, but he can't read a word of music, you know.
Right.
So when we were in the studio there, he wanted a flute. And no one in his band could play a flute. So he gets one of these studio musicians, and the guy comes in, and he's like polyester, you know, with a coat and tie on and all. You know, and he said, Mr. Daniels, may I see the music for this? And Charlie said, I don't have any music, son. Just come with me. I'm going to hum you what I need. So Charlie just hummed what he wanted, and the guy picked up and did that, you know. But one other interesting story on this. Here I go to Nashville with this guy, and it was cold as hell, you know. So this guy, we're in the taxi cab, and the guy in the taxi cab was a real old guy, and his grandson's sitting there. So we're driving into Nashville from the airport, and the kid lights up a joint, starts smoking it. And the old driver, the old man, are you smoking that dope again? You know, naturally, Louie, my friend, said, pass it back, babe. You know, so you know, so we're in this cab, and you know, it's the heater's on, and the damn, you know, I was whacked out of my mind, and I didn't even have a puff. I mean, it was all just circulating, you know. So we get to the hotel, and the old taxi cab driver is so stoned out of his mind, he gets out, takes our suitcases out, and says, thanks a lot, and drives off and didn't even charge us for the taxi ride.
Wow.
So anyway, that was an experience, you know. But
this film has one of your most solid exploitation casts. You had Christopher George, who is from Pieces, Gates of Hell, Grizzly, Day of the Animals, The Exterminator, Graduation Day, Enter the Ninja. You had Roberta Collins from a whole bunch of Filipino productions like The Big Dollhouse, Wonder Woman and Caged Heat, Dead Fresh 2000, The Witch Came to the Sea. Bill Kerwin, once again, from any number of H.G. Lewis films and Harry Kerwin Pictures, plus your own Hook Generation and Impulse. And J.G. Patterson, Dr. Gore himself. Chris and Bill were famous for being heavy drinkers. Do you have any booze hound stories from all that?
Yeah, well, Chris went over to me over to Nashville with Charlie, and they were both big drinkers, you know. But well, I'll tell you an interesting story on Chris. You know, Chris had just done El Dorado with John Wayne, and he did some other film with John Wayne. I forget which it was. But anyway, Chris shows up in the mountains with me, and he said, well, where's my trailer? I have a trailer. I said, I got one Winnebago, and that's for makeup, wardrobe, and you 4 actors. He said, but on John Wayne's movie, I had my own trailer. And I said, you're on a Bill Griffey movie now. You're not on a John Wayne movie. You know? So he was a pretty good sport, you know. So now we had to go out into the mountains shooting, and so we had the 2 girls, Roberta, and some of the girls on the crew. So I got these 2 porta potties, and I put them on a flatbed truck or trailer. And so the head grip came to me and said, Bill, how are we going to tow this out to the location? He said, we're towing the generator behind the grip truck. And I said, well, hell, the RV that the actors have, it's got a trailer hitch. Put it on that, you know. So they towed these 2 porta potties. And Chris George came up to me and he said, Griffey, I've put up with a lot with you, but if Hollywood ever finds out I had to tow two shitters out the location, I'll never work in Hollywood again. You know? So he was a pretty good sport about it, you know. But Roberta, they had a big thing, you know. Roberta committed suicide. I don't know if you knew that or not, because her young daughter had died, you know. And so they had a big thing out of the New Beverly for Roberta. She was a great gal. And, but we had a rap party on Whiskey Mountain,
right.
And I had half a Georgia crew that had worked on Deliverance, and they were rough mountain guys,
right.
And half the Miami crew. And it was one of these days, it was like 33 degrees, hadn't quite snowed, and it was drizzling rain. It was miserable. So we hired this place called Moon Valley, and we had a private rap party there. And so this van drives up with these four young guys from Atlanta, and they came in, and they said, we want to have a drink. And Miss Moon said, well, I'm sorry, this is a private party. And they push her aside, and they go up to the bar and pour themselves a drink. And one of the mountain guys, his name was Booger, and he looked like a linebacker for the NFL. And so this guy shoves him aside to get a drink, and Booger let this guy have a right hand, and this guy went down, boom, he didn't know what hit him.
Right.
So now this big John Wayne fight starts, you know, and between my crew and the mountain guys, the head of the mountain guys was a guy named Frank Rickman. I grabbed Frank, I said, grab these other couple of these guys, I'll grab one of them, and we got to get them out of here. They're going to get killed, you know.
Right.
So Frank grabs two of them, and I grab the other guy, and we go out in this mud. We're getting them to their van, and the idiot, one guy hit Frank Rickman, and now they were holding Booger from killing these guys. So some guy yelled, they hit Frank, turn Booger loose. You know, so now Booger's out there, and this idiot hit me. Now I got the guy in a headlock, and we're in the mud wrestling, and my wife comes running out with my daughter Melanie, and they each grab one of my legs, and they're pulling me and the guy through the mud, you know. So this was the rap party to end all rap parties, you know. But anyway, that was part of Whiskey Mountain, yeah.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Bill Grafay. In our final segment, we discuss his adventures in producing and advertising, and a few final stories from on set, and we're here on Third Eye Cinema.
Johnson, which I produced, I did not direct. Cease Fire, people familiar with Don Johnson, who, you know, starred in Miami Vice and so forth, is the best thing he ever did in his life. And that's a heck of a statement. I mean, he was fantastic in it. And we're talking about an independent film.
Right.
It's the only film in the history of cinema that was written up in the Congressional Record and was screened at the Library of Congress for the U.S. Senate and House.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, Rex Reed and Judith Kriss and all the big critics raved about it. And, you know, Rex Reed never said a good thing about it was written by George Fernandez, who is a Vietnam veteran, and so they approached me to produce the film. We went out to California, and Don Johnson had only done one film of note, and that was A Boy and His Dog. And so Don had just got out of rehab. He was on drugs and alcohol and all. So we took a gamble on him, and he really did a fantastic job. He stayed sober the whole thing. And when we were shooting, Michael Mann and Yorkovich, who was the writer of Miami Vice, and naturally Michael Mann was the exec producer, they were in Miami looking at locations and all. And back in California, they were doing like a cattle call because they wanted actors that weren't really that well known, you know. So Don's agent kept bugging Michael Mann, "I've got an actor working in Miami," and so forth. Michael Mann called me up and said, "You know, can we see some dailies on this guy? Because this agent's driving me nuts, you know."
Right.
So we showed him the dailies of some of the best scenes Don had done, and the rest is history. Don got Miami Vice based on ceasefire dailies, you know.
Wow.
So it's a situation that an independent film, that the best thing, as I said earlier, the best thing I ever learned was from Sam Arkoff, where he said people never ask how much a film costs to make. They went for one reason, you know. We released theatrically, and, you know, we were bumping heads with Spielberg and Lucas and everybody, and we did great theatrically. And then we made an HBO deal, which paid the budget of the film. So anyway, we came out smelling like a rose on that film. But there was a Vietnam veteran in Congress, and he made it's written up in the Congressional Record, he made a speech on the floor of the House, you know, and they wrote it up in the Congressional Congress, and he more or less was the champion of getting the thing shown at the Library of Congress. But it's saying we use a lot of real Vietnam veterans in the film. And, you know, I have two projects now. One is the DVD we're releasing on my lost film, The Devil Sisters. Then I just did a full seminar on independent filmmaking, which really covers guerrilla filmmaking, because I've been to so many of these seminars, you know, and they're talking to college kids that are film students and young filmmakers, and they say, "Oh, I just finished this $100 million film, and how Angelina Jolie's agent was driving me crazy," you know, and they go on and on about these $100 million films and dealing with Paramount. Well, you know, that doesn't help a young filmmaker at all, you know.
Right.
So everybody kept bugging me to do this, and, you know, so I covered a full day, and these are two DVDs that are up 5.5 hours of covering everything from finance, distribution, and so forth. Any young filmmakers might be listening to your program might be interested in that. So anyway, if they're interested, you go to www.realitiesedgefilms.com. That's Realities with a S, plural. RealitiesEdgeFilms.net. I think they'd enjoy seeing a real guerrilla filmmaker covering all points of independent filmmaking. That film I produced in Jamaica, there was a lot of stories about that, you know, where I did some things that was against, like, the lady that was the exec producer knew nothing about filmmaking, you know, and I was fanatic for prep when I went over there. First, they had hired a California producer, and when you produce in the islands, well, it's a whole different ball game, you know, a lot of the mentality of the Jamaicans and the Bahamians and so forth. Anyway, they fired this California producer, and they called me up, "Bill, you got to get down here," because I knew the young director. They said, "You've got to get down here and produce this movie, jump on a plane, get to Jamaica." And I said, "Well, it didn't quite work that way." You know, I said, "Send me a round trip ticket and half my salary and I'll come down," you know. So anyway, I went down, and here's where I did something completely against my character. Is I in pre-production, I'd given wardrobe and I'd given props and everybody the money to go into Kingston to buy stuff. So anyway, they come back a couple days before shooting. "Where's everything?" And they said, "Oh, well, the executive producer took the money away from us, and we don't have anything." I said, "You don't have anything? We're shooting Monday, you know." So the exec producers had this, like, 28-year-old son, and so my wife was down just visiting for the weekend. So I said to the kid, I said, do you have a credit card? And he says, oh, yes. And I said, go with my wife. And I told Grace, and this one actor had come in, and here he's supposed to be a sophisticated, well-dressed guy, and he had no wardrobe, you know. And so anyway, long story short, my wife went down, and the place we were staying, everything was like triple, you know, like a belt you'd get in Jamaica for 10 or 15 bucks. There was 75 or 100, you know.
Right.
So anyway, we got the whole wardrobe out of the hotel, which cost. So now I always do the exteriors first in case we get a bad weather. We can always fall back to an interior. But I knew if we went on the streets of Jamaica, we were dead in the water because of the control. So anyway, I did 5 days of interior in a house we had already secured. Then another thing I did on that film is that we ended up in some little town, and we were shooting ruins of this building. And so we laid the cable from the generator, and we were all ready to go. And like 40 or 50 Jamaicans show up with machetes, and they said, we want to work, Mon. And I said, well, there's no work. We've got our crew and all this, you know. We want to work, Mon. And so I said to the first AD, I'm going to wrap this. We're taking off. And he said, what, are we wrapping for the day? And I said, no. I noticed about 5 miles down the road, there were some ruins. And I said, I'm taking off in my car, and you wrap the crew and in the trucks and the cable and follow me down that road. And if you see my car on the side, stop. So I roared down the road, and there's this old Jamaican sitting next to this ruin in a little hut. And I said, hey, Bond, you want $100 US? Yeah, Mon, yeah. So anyway, we were shooting about 11 or 12 o'clock that day, you know. But the only trouble with shooting in Jamaica, we did great in the morning, but at lunchtime, the Jamaican crew and half of the guys I knew were all on
smoking ganja.
So everything was slow motion in the afternoon. But we did great shooting in the daytime, you know? In the morning, I should say. So anyway, I could go on and on and on with sea stories, but I'll leave you with one, which is a classic. I knew this hippie writer from the old days. He moved out to California, and he lives up in the mountains in Northern California, and he's always writing scripts and so forth, and he's always sending me a screenplay and wanting me to get an agent. So I was out of town, and he calls my wife, and his name's Bobby, and he said, Grace said, hi, Bobby, how are you? And she said, oh, well, I woke up this morning, and my wife was dead in bed next to me. And they just hauled her away. Listen, did Bill ever talk to that agent about my script? And my wife said, what are you, Bobby, your wife died and you're worried about an agent? So that's just one of the classic things you experience in this insane business, you know.
I don't think you ever said, what's the name of this film that you were working on in Jamaica?
It's called The House Next Door. Do you want to know the end result of that film? This, I'm not mentioning any names, but the people involved in it were from California, but they were Jamaicans. They embezzled all the money to make the film, and the young director I knew, who was from California, took it back, and when he finished editing, he called me up and said, Bill, are you sitting down? I said, yeah, why? He said, Los Angeles Times, these people are in jail for embezzling all the money to make film. and so I assume the people they embezzle from owns the film, but it's never been released. So anyway, but having all the cat and nine tail marks on my back, I got paid U.S. dollars up front every week, you know. It was sort of a suspense thing, The House Next Door, and, you know, it wasn't the greatest script in the world, you know. But, oh, another thing happened on that film, which the executive producer's daughter thought she was a writer, And she knew nothing about on a rewrite. You know, when you do a rewrite, you put green pages, red pages, blue pages, pink pages, or whatever in the script. And so she didn't know about that. And every night she'd rewrite the script and print up all new scripts and hand them out. So they're shooting this one day, and the first AD calls me and said, "Bill, you got to get out to the set. We got a problem." And so I rush out to the set, and here the DP had one script, the director had another script, every actor had a different script. Nobody had the same script. So I gathered all the crew and all the actors together, and I put all five scripts out in a line, and I said, "I don't give a flying, you know what, what script you shoot, but we're not shooting another foot of film until you pick one script, and we'll go by that one, you know." So anyway, that was a nightmare to do that film. You know, a lot of people talk to me about working. You know, I've done three projects with Shatner.
Right.
And they say, "Well, how do you get along with Shatner? I hear he's temperamental and this and that." And I've never had any problem with Shatner. I mean, we got great, you know. And I've had more people say this and that. But, you know, I don't know what it is, but you just click with some people, you know.
How about Harold Sakata? I mean, what was it like working with him? Because his primary role, other than your films, was just he was silent. He was just some guy that threw his hats around.
Right. Well, Sakata was a very gentle giant and really super nice guy. And, you know, he was a professional wrestler. And the way he got on the Bond film was he was wrestling in London, and Cubby saw him wrestling on TV and made him into an actor. But when we finished Mako Jaws of Death, he was my house guest for 3 days. And my poor wife, the guy ate like a dozen eggs for breakfast. My poor wife, all she was cooking all the time for him, you know. But he was, you know, a super, super gentle giant type of guy, you know.
Christopher George and Bill Kerwin, and both of those guys were famous for being heavy drinkers. So did you have any stories about them being all boozed up and doing something crazy on the set?
No. Kerwin, he could drink like a fish, you know. I mean, but he could always drive home. You know, he was one of those drunks that could handle himself. But Chris didn't drink that much, except when we were in Nashville with Charlie Daniels. We had some moonshine, and that was part. So, you know, if anybody lit a cigarette when you'd taken a swig of that, you were like one of these guys in the circus. You'd blow out the fire out of your mouth. You know? That's one other story. I got to tell you, one other story on Whiskey Mountain. The leader of the mountain guys was a guy named Frank Rickman. He was also the location scout for Deliverance and help Deliverance and all that. So I'm out looking at locations, and Frank says, "Do you want to meet the biggest moonshiner in these mountains?" And I said, yeah. And so we stopped at a little general store, and he said, "I got to call him on the phone first, because he'll shoot us if we don't, he doesn't know who we are, you know."
Right.
So we drive up and we get out, and this guy, his name was Bowser Patterson. And old Bowser, I don't know if you remembered Wallace Berry, old actor. Well, he looked like Wallace Berry. He had like a 5-day growth of beard, you know. And so he looks at me, and he's a flatlander, you know, they call us flatlanders up there. So Frank said, "Break out some moonshine. We want to drink, Bowser." So he looks at me, and he said, "No, Bill's okay. Break out some." So he goes over to this big old dog house that he had, an old hound dog there, and he lifts the dog house up on hinges, and he takes a pump and he screws it into the ground, and he had like a 50-gallon oak drum of moonshine in the dog house. pours this out of court, and they're drinking this moonshine, and this conversation is going. Frank says, "Boy, they're going to throw the key away on you now, Bowser. The Fed's got you right and left this time." Bowser said, "It ain't me, it's them damn Girl Scouts in the valley. What the hell?" I said, "Girl Scouts? Why did they arrest you?" You know, because the moonshiners, you know, the Feds go through looking for moonshine still. So anyway, what the deal was, is some enterprising guys out of Atlanta came up there, and they said, "Bowser, you know, all these years you've been making moonshine, just plant these seeds for us and you can make 10 times more money." So Bowser had 5 acres of corn and he had 5 acres of marijuana next to the corn. And when the Feds came in looking for stills, they find all this marijuana growing. And in court, Bowser said it was a damn Girl Scouts. They planted it. And I thought it was weeds. I kept trying to pull it out, but the Girl Scouts kept planting it. So anyway, that's just another story on Whiskey Mountain. Yeah.
After making all these films, what led to your pretty much ending your exploitation film career? Because, you know, with that movie, you moved into production and the occasional second unit direction role, and you helmed a number of commercials. So how much of a change was it for you, and do you feel it was for the better, or did you miss being in the driver's seat?
Well, the thing in a nutshell was, I hate to admit it, but I became a mercenary. And I used to go to a restaurant called Mike Gordon's, and the president and all the vice presidents of Bacardi Rum used to come for lunch there. And so I met them, and they do half-hour films. You know, at the time they weren't allowed to do commercials on TV of hard liquor, you know. They do these half-hour films. So they said, "Bill, we're bringing down these New York production companies and directors. Why don't you try one?" So I tried one for them, and they loved it so much, I ended up doing 25 films for them. And it was like walking in the street and finding duffel bags full of $100 bills. So I sort of became a whore, I guess. So I did those, and I did tons of, I can't remember how many commercials I directed. And so I drifted away from features, just becoming a mercenary, you know. And like one of the Jamaican films I did, which was at the distillery, I'm sorry, not the Jamaican film, Puerto Rican film. They have a distillery in Puerto Rico. I wrote this thing about where this movie company is shooting at Morro Castle there, and then they take the helicopter and they fly over the distillery and we go through the distillery. So I called up Shatner and I said, "Shatner, you and your girlfriend want to come to Puerto Rico and do this film with me?" And so anyway, I made a deal with Shatner. This is how Shatner is funny. He calls me back and he said, "Well, how much you got in the budget for wardrobe?" All he needed was slacks and a shirt, you know. So I said, "Well, I guess, you know, you can pick up something for about $100. And Shatner says, "Well, maybe I could go to Kmart and find something." Anyway, but he was a good sport, so I use Shatner in that. And I'll leave you with one other Shatner bit. When I walked in, you know, he's got about 40 horses up in Kentucky. You know, he's got a ranch in Kentucky, right. And he's a horse nut. So when I walked in to see him, I said, "Hey, Bill, how's the horses doing?" And he looked at me real serious. He says, "Let me tell you this, Griffey, you never invest in something that eats while you're sleeping. Can you imagine how much it costs to feed 40 horses?"
Yeah.
To keep them up. So anyway, enough of my sea stories.
I understand that your daughter was actually Big Edna in Porky's too. That's a strange credit to have on the resume.
Well, she was like a second or third assistant director at the time. And so they put her in that role. So she's still getting a dime or 25 cents residuals from SAG on that, but that's the only thing she ever acted in, you know. But you know, she's done all those big $100 million films like Waterworld and, you know, the 6 Days, Seven Nights with Harrison Ford.
But that kind of struck me because that was the only credit I saw her for acting, like Big Edna.
Right. Anyway, again, I just want to mention, I think everybody would love to see The Devil Sisters because I think it's one of the best things I ever did. And so if they go to that website, realityedgefilms.net, they can pick that up. And any filmmakers that want to see about the seminar I did on guerrilla filmmaking, pick it up, and I think they'll get their money's worth.
So looking back, it seems like you tend to hammer at the same themes or types of films in pairs or bunches, because, you know, you got Stanley and Mako, The Hook Generation, The Psychedelic Priest, Sting of Death and Tartu, Checkered Flag, Racing Fever, and Wild Rebels, and maybe you could even pair off like Wild Rebels and Whiskey Mountain without too much of a stretch. So why is that? Do you see yourself like, say, a Jess Franco or a Jean Roland, where you're continually reworking an idea until you get it the way you want it? Or is it more just a case of expedience, as in, you know, hey, it worked before, let's try another one?
No. As I keep repeating, you're not listening to me. I'm a mercenary. And I'll give you a quick mercenary story. You want to hear this one?
Sure.
When I did Stanley, Crown International sent me around the country to promote it.
Right.
And so we ended up, I can't remember where, Cairo, Illinois or someplace, and it was a Saturday, you know, and they always put a front man out that knows the critics and all, you know. So anyway, Saturday we go in, and this old gal was a film critic, and she says to this front guy, "Charlie, you know I never work on Saturday. What the hell did you drag me in here for?" And I thought to myself, oh, brother, she's going to tear us to ribbons. You know? She starts in on me, and she's saying, "Well, when you developed Stanley and you directed it, what were your innermost thoughts? Were you, you know?" And she gets into all this Fellini and Bergman and all of this stuff, you know. So I just looked at her, and I said, "None of the above." She said, "Why did you do the film?" I said, "Because I thought it would make a hell of a lot of money." and she looked at me and she says, "Do you know you're the first honest son of a bitch that's ever been in this office?" And she gave us a great write-up, because I didn't try and BS her, you know, with all this.
I stand guilty as charged of that, because that's kind of the focus of the show. I'm always looking for deeper themes. I'm always looking for meanings and things that go throughout somebody's filmography or whatever. And a lot of times it's just, hey, you know, I made a buck. What the hell?
Right. Well, you know, it's a situation that, I mean, the only film I've made that I with a true labor of love was Cease Fire. You know, all the rest, I just, you know, I mean, it's satisfying to know that tens of millions of people all over the world have seen my films, you know, so there's satisfaction there. Plus, as we say in South Florida, a few pesos here and there helps, you know.
I was going to ask if you had any upcoming projects you wanted to promote to the listeners, but I know that you mentioned about your seminar and about The Devil Sisters coming out. And yesterday you had said that you're trying to locate a good print so that you can put out Whiskey Mountain. So is there anything else?
I've been approached by two other producers to direct, and we've got two films. And, you know, I have a saying, it's all BS till the money's in the bank. You know?
Right.
But one project's called Marooned, which is a good, you know, horror-type film. And the other one is called The Iceman. They actually were changing the title to The Ice Morgue. You know, if those fly, I'll be back to directing theatrical films instead of all the commercials and all. So
you're still doing commercials to this day?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I just keep, when you get film in your blood, how the hell are you going to get it out? You know, you can't get it out, you know. You know, as long as I can keep moving, I keep working, you know.
So do you have anything else you wanted to touch on before we go to the close?
No, just keep your eye out for Marooned and The Ice Morgue. I don't know how they're going to really get the money, but now the guy with The Ice Morgue, they told me, I'm not producing, so don't hold me this, but they said that they approached Rob Zombie to do a bit part in it, and he's dying to work with William Griffey, which it strokes my ego if that's the if that's for real, you know. But don't, I'm not taking that to the bank till Rob shows up, and then I'm going to try and talk Herschel into doing a bit part if we get this off the ground too. You know?
Wow, that'd be great. So with that, Bill, I'd like to thank you again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and I'd love to have you back sometime in the future to discuss whatever you have on tap.
All right, terrific. And if I ever come up to New York and freeze my ass off, I'll stop in and see you.
Thanks, Bill.
I didn't say that my real nickname is Wild Bill. And, so anyway, this is Wild Bill Griffey signing off.
All right, well, thanks again, Bill. It was a real pleasure talking to you for these 2 days.
All right, stay warm and break a leg.
Take care, Bill.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Wild Bill Griffey. Next week on Week 55 of Third Eye Cinema, Bjorn A. Brennan, goth industrial metal crossover rap, Goth Minister. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician who'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema is a Big Papa online network on Blog Talk Radio. Or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website and Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive, listener, download at your convenience. And next week...
Hi, this is Goth Minister. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.